December 26, 2004. That was the day a huge earthquake happened. In fact, it's the third largest earthquake ever recorded, and it had the longest duration of faulting that has ever been observed, between 8 and 10 minutes. But there was something different about this earthquake. It happened underwater. It took place in the Indian Ocean. The epicenter was off the west coast of northern Sumatra, Indonesia. The result of this enormous earthquake happening under the ocean was that it created massive waves of water up to 100 feet or about 30 meters high. These waves arrived without warning. More than 227,000 people woke up that morning and went through their normal routine, not realizing it was their last day to be alive.
Good evening. More than 11,000 people are now thought to have been killed in southern Asia after an undersea earthquake sent enormous waves rolling across the Indian Ocean. The quake measured 8.9 on the Richter scale, the biggest in the world for 40 years. Waves up to 10 meters high engulfed the coasts of many countries. The quake's epicenter was off the island of Sumatra in northwestern Indonesia, where more than 4,000 people are thought to have died. In Sri Lanka, officials say more than 3,000 people have been killed and more than a million affected. In southern India, 3,000 people, mostly fishermen, are reported dead. At least 300 have been killed in southern Thailand, including some tourists, and hundreds of people are missing. And waves swamped the low-lying Maldive Islands, leaving the capital Male two-thirds underwater. Gareth Furby reports.
For many tourists in southern Thailand, this was a paradise. Not anymore. Survivors here evacuated on the island of PP, well known to many as the perfect setting for the movie The Beach. And from a tourist in the Maldives, this account of her survival.
We didn't realize, we just saw a water plane coming up and towards the building, and people from outside screaming, and then we saw the water come in the building and very fast.
Pictures from Indian television show the water overwhelming large areas of the coast. Hundreds of fishermen are among those reported missing. India's Prime Minister says everything possible will be done to help those affected.
My heart goes out in sympathy to all those families who have lost their dear ones.
Sri Lanka has declared a national disaster and is appealing for international aid.
I remember when it happened. It was a Sunday, the day after Christmas. Of course, it was the leading news story all over the world. I heard how the story unfolded, how the underwater earthquake happened, and the unbelievable numbers as the death toll kept rising. It was an incredible tragedy. But I was in the U.S., and that horrific scene was on the other side of the world. It didn't seem real. But for my guest today, Aaron, that scene was very real. He was there. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a man standing in front of me in my bedroom.
My friend has been shot.
I'm in the literally inside the river, and I'm inside my car.
He had told me multiple times that he was going to set himself on fire.
If you say my name or try to look at me, I'm going to kill you.
And he was just sobbing. He said, Mom, Mom, tell me you're going to be okay.
And I jumped on the hood of the car, and I held on.
And I looked into the garage, and he was hanging from the rafters.
I had somebody standing on my neck.
He's better to me dead. I want him dead.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast, and at the top, click on Try Free, and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad, and then on with today's episode. I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm not a rock climber, so I got to ask you this. Why is the rock climbing in Thailand among the best in the world?
Well, first off, it's probably the only rock climbing you can do in your bare feet in a perfect white sand beach, which is really unusual. You know, it's like half a kind of beach sunbathing, half extreme sport, which is a really nice combination. But they also just have these beautiful kind of limestone cliffs just jutting out of the jungle, and a lot of them are actually out to sea, which is really special because you can do this thing called deep water soloing, which is, you get a boat out there and the boat goes right up to the edge of the cliff and you hold on and you climb up, but there's no rope. It just is a kind of overhanging cliff. And if you fall, you just fall into the deep ocean. So it's really fun for that. I tried a bit of that, but I don't know if my climbing skills were up to, or maybe it was just like my mental skills were up to letting me get too high up there. But yeah, we loved it. My now wife, but girlfriend and I were traveling around there and we were both big into rock climbing at the time. And it was a beautiful place to go and visit.
Awesome. It sounds beautiful. I've never been to Thailand. I'd love to go there sometime. When this happened, you had the whole month of December off work.
Yeah, I we both worked for the same company. We met there. It was a music management company called IE Music in London. And I had the best boss. He was like this total rock and roll 60s boss, you know, used to work for Island Records and manage a bunch of the big bands there, T-Rex. And it was just one of those offices which was a lot of fun to work with. We would work all really hard during the year, and then he would just shut down the office through December. Every December, he'd be like, right, that's it. I'm out of here. That means you're out of here too. And if you didn't have a tour on or something like that, you were allowed to just go. So Jill and I would just kind of go backpacking for a month every December. For about 4 or 5 years, we did that, which is a really amazing way to see a country, you know, to have that amount of time to properly get it into you and enjoy it. So Thailand was, I think, our second trip that we did that.
And you went there specifically for the rock climbing, right? Or I mean, obviously they have other things that you can do there.
We went there for the rock climbing and the diving, really. Yeah, we went. So we flew over to Bangkok, and it is an incredible place. If you've never been to Asia, there's just something about the otherness of it, which is really different to traveling in America or Europe, or even South America in a way. It feels like a very different country. And Bangkok is kind of mad and crazy, and you go and see the temples and all that sort of stuff. But we got out there pretty quickly and then went down to Phuket, which is an island down in the south, and it's really great for diving. So we went there and did our paddy course and spent about 5 days there. And then we got a ferry over to Krabi, which is this region just off the coast of Phuket, really a couple hours off the coast. And it was there we were intending to go to this island called Koh Phi Phi. We had made these plans to spend Christmas on this island. It's like this beautiful paradise island. It's basically almost like an atoll with a double beach. So you're on the beach and you have like ocean on both sides of you, and beautiful mountains, and just a really chill place. And that's where we had planned to go. But on the ferry, we just met some people. It's one of those ferries where there's like an open air deck, and we went up there and we met some other travelers and saw that they had some rock climbing equipment on and stuff. And we went up to them and we said, "Oh, hey, you know, we're climbers too. We're looking for a really good place to go. We've heard it's amazing. Where's the best place to go?" And they said, "You have to go to this beach called Tonsai. It's like the place to go. It's filled with climbers. You'll absolutely love it." And so the ferry was actually stopping at Ralai Beach, which is right next door to Tonsai. And on the spur of the moment, we decided to not go to Koh Phi Phi, but to stop here on Tonsai instead and spend a few days there. And that decision ended up being an absolutely critical decision and a real stroke of luck.
Before we get into that part, I remember you, when you originally told me about this, you had a bad feeling about this trip on the way, like in the plane.
Yeah. And before then too, it was really weird. It was one of those things that I really can't explain now. And I couldn't explain then either. It was, you know, I'm not someone who I'm not 100% cynical, but at the same time, I'm not someone who necessarily believes in, you know, supernatural things or psychic phenomenon or anything like that. But I really can't deny what happened. And I just had this feeling leading up to this trip that something bad was going to happen. And I kept putting it out of my mind. I was talking to Jill about it, and I kept putting it out of my mind. Like, stop being so ridiculous. You know, you're just stressed at work. You've got too much going on. It's just stuff like that kind of bleeding over into this. And that's why you're feeling like that. But I couldn't shake it. And like, I went to see my mom before I left to make sure that I'd sort of said goodbye to her and given a hug. I did lots of things like that. You know,
Yeah, that sounds really serious. I mean, you've gone on trips like this before. Have you ever had a feeling like that?
Never. And never since. Like, you know, I'm always really excited before I go on a trip, kind of trying to absorb all the different things we're going to see and read background. And yeah, it's just pure excitement. I've never had a bad feeling about it. And that's why it was so strange. And I kind of just forcibly put it out of my mind. But when we got to the plane, when I actually got on the plane and they closed the doors, I started hyperventilating. I basically felt myself having a kind of panic attack, which I had had sometimes in the past, but hadn't had for years. And so I kind of knew what it was. And I said to Jill, I think we're going to die there. I don't know why. I feel like we're not going to make it back. You know, I was on the verge of tears. And and she was sort of calming me down, and she's like, "Oh my, do you want to get off the plane?" I'm like, no, I'm just being stupid, you know, but I had this such a strong feeling. And afterwards, to this day, I can't really reconcile where that came from or why I had that. And I know people listening will think, "Oh, you know, it's just a coincidence." And, you know, I know how memory works, and you can kind of implant things in your memory post-dated. But I just have to say that that's not the case in this instance. You know, I really did have a strong instinctual feeling that just kept coming back and back again.
Hey, you know, some things you just can't explain, but you know, what happened. So anyway, okay. So you went to Tonsai.
Yes.
And you were looking for a place on the beach, and what happened when you got there?
The really interesting thing in the setup to this is there were just a number of incidents which happened, which led to us kind of surviving this. And there were so many of them that it's so strange to look back and think of all those coincidences, of all those kind of roads branching. And if you'd gone down one route, you would have had a completely different outcome. So the first one was not going to Koh Phi Phi. Koh Phi Phi ended up being one of the absolute worst hit islands in the whole of Thailand, because it's this really shallow island. And when the wave hit it, it completely overran the whole beach. And
that was your original plan, was to spend Christmas there.
Yeah. You know, and Jill really wanted to do that too. I mean, she was into the climbing as well, but she's like, look, we want to have a holiday as well. We want to chill out. This is like the paradise island. So we had always planned to spend it there, but there's very little high ground there. So there was a lot of casualties on that island. And we would almost certainly have tried to get a place on the beach. And that was the second thing that happened. So you basically get off on this, the ferry on this place called Ao Nang. And then you have to get one of the little Thai longtail fishing boats down to Raleigh Beach. So it's really like this, you know, The Beach, the book and the movie, which is like this, Alex Garland wrote it, which is like this kind of hidden backpacker paradise where, you know, it's hard to access and people don't know about it. And that's a little bit like what Ton Sai is like. But in order to access it, you have to get this boat to Raleigh Beach. And we arrived and it's this absolutely spectacular place. Like if you can imagine a photograph of a tropical paradise, this is it. It's like beautiful limestone crags covered in jungle, rising up from this perfect beach and turquoise water and little Thai fishing boats and really nice hotels along the, you know, very, very well done and authentic, nothing high rise along the beach and, you know, monkeys in the jungle. It's just an incredible place. And so we got off and we're like, Raleigh Beach is so nice. And let's try and get a guest house here instead. This is so nice. And Jill really wanted to do it. We walked around and we tried and tried and tried to find somewhere, and it was all booked out. It was coming up to Christmas and it was all completely booked out. And we were so disappointed. And actually, I watched the trailer for the Impossible movie, and the hotel that's set in, that they stay in, is the hotel that we were trying to stay at. That was our number one choice. And we were so disappointed. You know, we walked around for a couple hours and we couldn't find anything. So in the end, we said, okay, well, let's go over to the next beach, Ton Sai. And that really is that sort of like hidden paradise. The only way you can get there is by hiking over this really steep jungle pass, or in low tide, you can kind of wade around this headland in the water. There's no other way to get there. So people have to work to get there, and it's a real climbing community. And we arrived and it was just a beautiful place, but more of a sort of backpacker budget place, like little shacks on the beach and like really cool little open air bars and music playing and that kind of thing. And again, we walked up and down this beach trying to find like one of these little beach cabanas to stay in. There was a few of them and they're absolutely gorgeous and nothing doing, super disappointed. And we kind of gradually made our way backwards. We wanted to be as close to the beach as we could. And we gradually made our way further and further away. And as we did that, we went further and further uphill. Ton Sai, unlike Raleigh Beach, has a really steep slope up from the beach up a mountain. And we were absolutely gutted. The only place that we could find was right up in the mountain. It was like probably a quarter of a mile up this steep path, right in the jungle. And that was the only place we could find. So at the time, we were really gutted. But had we stayed in that guest house in Raleigh, that hotel in Raleigh, that was one of the hardest hit of anywhere in our region. It was completely overwhelmed by the wave when it came in. And had we stayed on the beach in Ton Sai, all the places that we would have stayed in were completely obliterated by the wave too. So where we ended up staying was one of the few places that didn't get any damage because it was so far up the hill. So incredible set of kind of fortuitous circumstances which steered us away from Koh Phi Phi, away from Raleigh Beach, and then away from the beach of Ton Sai. And then it just got stranger after that.
Well, that's what we want to hear about. You know, I'm going to ask you though, you're an experienced traveler. The question that comes to my mind is, like, if I'm going to travel someplace, I'm going to make reservations at a hotel or an Airbnb or something ahead of time. Why wouldn't you do that?
You know, we were in our 20s and stupid and just wanted to be, and just kind of wanted to backpack, or we used to call it flash pack, because we weren't quite that sort of backpacker age. And, you know, we both had decent jobs in London. So we would sort of do the backpacking thing for a few days and then we would stay somewhere nice for a couple of days. And, but we still had this sort of like sense of we're just free and easy and, you know, we're just gonna see what happens. And it's lucky we did, because if we had made reservations, they would have been on Koh Phi Phi and we wouldn't have been able to change our plans. I mean, now I'm in my early 40s now. I definitely make reservations now, because the reality of not making reservations is that you spend your entire time walking around trying to find somewhere to stay. So yeah, I've learned my lesson, but it was very fortuitous that I hadn't learned it by the time I went.
Yeah, back then it was great to be spontaneous, right?
Yeah, back in those days, that's right. So we spent about a week there and we kept talking about leaving and we were just having a good time. And we met some Thai friends that ran a local bar there and they were really into the climbing scene and they were sort of showing us around. And it was a really beautiful, beautiful time, fires on the beach in the evening. And we just kept saying, okay, one more day. And then eventually it got to Christmas Day and we were still there and we're like, okay, we're here for that now. And we'd been vegetarian the whole time because when you travel, particularly to more remote places in Thailand, especially Ton Sai, where there's really no refrigeration, you know, it's sensible not to eat meat because, you know, you're probably not going to get food poisoning that way. So we were vegetarian, but our little guest house had done this like Western style, particularly British style, big Christmas dinner buffet feast, right? With turkey and, you know, roast potatoes and all the works. And they were so excited that they'd done this for us, you know. And on the night, Jill felt so bad. They kept coming up and saying, oh, we've done this special thing for all you guys. And we're so excited for you to have it. And we sat down for the dinner, and because we were vegetarian, we weren't eating any of the turkey, but they kept coming up and saying, you know, don't you want to try some of the turkey? We made it specially. We brought it all over to this island for you. And we were sort of being polite. And then eventually Jill said, God, I feel so bad for mom. I'm just going to go get some. And she went and got a little bit, just a little piece and ate it. And it was just, you know, happy Christmas. We've had some turkey. Great. And later that night, she got violently ill from it. She got terrible food poisoning from it. So we canceled the plans we'd made the next day. And the plans we'd made the next day were to go diving. We'd just done this paddy course in Phuket and we wanted to go. We hadn't done any more diving since then. We wanted to go out and do that. So we'd booked this paddy course to go diving.
Let me just say, for people that aren't divers, paddy is PADI. And what does that stand
that's
for?
That's right. Professional Association of Diving International. And I think it's that anyway. And it's basically the course you have to do to go diving. And, you know, it's usually like 3 days or so, the basic level course we did, but we had it. So now we could go diving, you know, still with a company, but, we were able to go down to about 20, 25 meters. And we hadn't really used this certification yet. So we're like, okay, day after Christmas, this is going to be perfect. And we booked this day out to do a couple of dives.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%. So I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great, and I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
But then on that morning, she had such a rough night that I canceled it, basically. I said, you know, we can't go out. She's not well. We'll do it another day when she's better. That was the other thing. You know, if she hadn't eaten that piece of turkey, we would have gone out diving that day. And, you know, if you were on the water when the wave hit, there would have been absolutely no chance. So then I said goodbye to Jill. I was going to stay with her, but she said, no, you know, go off and have some fun. And I met up with my Thai mate, Joey, and we were going to go climbing together. And I remember he said to me, look, we have a choice of places we could go today. Like, I really like this place called Eagle Wall, which is here on Tonsai. It's really close, really easy. And he was kind of pushing it. And he said, or we could hike over to Raleigh Beach and then kind of climb up the other side of Raleigh Beach where there's this big limestone kind of crag, like almost like a hill covered in jungle that leads up to this cliff. And it's on a peninsula out to sea. And you go, and there's a really famous climbing route there called Lord of the Ties. And he's like, or we could go to the Lord of the Ties wall. And, I almost just flipped a coin in my head and said, you know what, let's do the hike over. And he's kind of like, you sure? You know, it's kind of a long hike. I said, yeah, I feel like doing that. Let's do the hike over. Well, it turns out that Eagle Wall, which is right on the beach and it's hemmed in. Once you get there, you have to wade across water to get there. And once you're there, there's no way out. Like you, the only way out is to wade back through the water. And the people that were really hurt on Tonsai were people that were climbing on Eagle Wall. A couple people survived by literally climbing up and holding on. But we didn't go there. And if we had, I mean, God knows what would have happened. But we went 50-50, we went to the other place. And as I said, he was kind of pushing that place. So I don't know why I chose that. But we hiked over to the other place and kind of climbed up there. And it was maybe the best place in the whole island to be because it was about 75 feet above the beach, above the ocean, you know, jutting out to sea. And we were climbing and having a good time. And it's this incredible feeling because you're climbing up this cliff and then you're literally just sort of dangling above this beautiful turquoise ocean. And while I'm doing that, I look out and I see this wall of white water, you know, really far away, but I see this wall of white water. And we've never had any surf in these beaches. It's always been absolutely calm. And I said to Joey, you know, do you guys get surf here? I've never seen anything like this. Check this out. And his face immediately dropped and he said, something's not right. This isn't right. He lived there. He was like a climbing guide and a local. And he knew instantly that something wasn't right because he'd never seen anything like this and knew that that shouldn't be happening here. But we had no warning. One of the reasons that a lot of people died. I think 240,000 people died around the Indian Ocean that day. And one of the reasons was there was no system in place for tsunami early warning system. So they knew this earthquake had happened, and they knew that this tsunami would be spreading out like this, just this ripple effect spreading out from the epicenter of the earthquake. But they had no way of letting people know. And that's one of the great tragedies of it was it could have been averted, but they had no system in place at that time. So we had no idea. And it was before the days where smartphones were ubiquitous. There was no way of like Googling whether or not this happened. There was really no Wi-Fi there unless you were like in one spot on the island. So we really had no way of figuring out what was happening. And we just watched this wall of water kind of slowly come towards us. And, you know, to be honest, I felt at that time that it was just like a big surf wave. I didn't feel like there was anything wrong or dangerous with it. And we could see behind it, there was another like two sets of it behind it. So it really just looked like if you were on a surf beach and you just saw like a big set of waves coming in, it just looked like that. But we were above it, so we didn't really have a perspective on how big it was. And underneath us was just sort of moored underneath us by the cliff was this sailing boat. And I watched this wall of water come up. And when it hit the sailing boat, it just immediately swallowed it, flipped this boat immediately and broke the mast, and the boat was just gone. So we knew then that it was something was terribly wrong. And the interesting thing, I suppose, is that before then, and I think for a lot of people, you know, you think of a tsunami and you think of a giant wave, you think of like a 50-foot wave. But it wasn't that in this case. What it was just an incredibly fast and powerful surge. And it brought so much water behind it. You know, your average wave is quite, doesn't have a lot of depth going back to it, right? But this just went back forever, it seemed, you know? So it was just this huge surge of water. And after it kind of took over this sailing boat, it went up onto the beach, and there's always these long-tail Thai fishing boats that are parked on the beach. You don't have to moor them. You can just sort of drag them up to the beach. And again, it just picked these things up and just, you couldn't see them anymore. It just threw them towards the hotel. So right on the edge of the beach where the jungle begins are all the nice hotels. And we just saw the water just surge up and smash through the hotel and just keep going and keep going. And everyone was watching at this point. Everyone knew that something bad was happening, but there was also this incredible surrealness to it. I'd never been in a disaster before. I didn't know what to expect or how I would react. But, you know, some people immediately were like, we have to get down. We have to go and see if everyone's all right. And they ran down. And other people, me included, and I'm not proud of this, were maybe in shock afterwards, but certainly at the time, I just felt like it wasn't real. I wasn't processing how dangerous it was. Because I saw that boat destroyed, I said, well, there's no one in that boat. There can't be anyone in that boat. Because had there been someone in that boat, they would have certainly been killed. And you could have, you know, I could see on the top of the boat, like a child's inflatable thing to play with. And I couldn't accept the reality of that. And the same, I couldn't accept the reality of what was happening to the hotel. I just felt like it was all going to be okay. So some people left and ran down the beach, which was a mistake because then the second and third wave hit. So it was lucky in a way that I wasn't processing it properly, and I wasn't one of those guys who immediately knew what to do.
Were those second and third waves, were they just as strong as the first one?
Yeah, they were. It was like three waves, one after another. They were a little bit apart. The wave came in, surged up, and the surge just seemed to keep going forever. And then it pulled back. And then after it pulled right back. And then after it pulled back, another wave hit. And a lot of the, you know, in general, people said over the Indian Ocean, there was a lot of the damage and devastation that was done was simply just pulled back into the ocean afterwards. The pull of that receding wave is incredibly strong. And actually, as the tsunami hits, you can feel the water. There's this famous picture of Raleigh Beach of these tourists standing on the beach and this family. And I know this family are okay, actually, because the article that reported this said, you know, this is a picture of a Norwegian family, but they all survived. And because it's quite a harrowing image to see, it's these parents and these kids trying to run away from the wave, but they're already sort of knee deep in water. And the pull of the water back is so strong that they're really struggling to run away, which is why when a tsunami hits, you have to get out there early, because if you're already in the water, you may well just get caught in it.
So people that were there and got hit on the incoming, if they survived that, now they're being sucked back out to sea.
Yeah, I mean, I think tragically, what we found out later was that we ran out of food afterwards. I'm jumping ahead, but we ran out of food afterwards. And the reason why is because all the fish were contaminated from eating the bodies of the people that had passed away, because a lot of that was just sucked back into the ocean, very sadly. And so after we didn't go down after the first wave, and then we saw the second and third wave hit, we were very nervous about like when it was going to come again, because in order to get down from our safe vantage point and get to the next vantage point, it was maybe 500 meters, like 1,500, 2,000 feet away. So it was quite a long way away. Like if you had to, you know, if you'd seen that wave coming in, you would have had to really sprint across the beach in order to get to the other high ground, because otherwise Raleigh was completely flat. And that was one of the problems too, that the area where all the hotels were was just completely flat for a long time. So there was no way to really escape from that. But after a while, we felt it was safe. And, you know, obviously Jill wasn't with me, and I was starting to get worried that she had left the house. Like I left her not feeling well, and I was pretty sure that she was just going to stay in our place, which I thought was going to be safe because it was so high up the mountain. But I started to get worried, like, what if she's come looking for me, you know? What if for some reason she's come down to the beach to see what's happening? And, you know, Jill is one of those people who is like just switches on in an emergency and knows what to do and wants to take control and is quite calm. And so I knew that she wouldn't be passive in this situation. She would wanting to help people and wanting to have a positive influence on it. So I started to get really worried that she'd gone down to the beach, and I really wanted to get back. So we kind of hiked down this path to the beach. And when we got there, it was absolutely shocking. We really couldn't tell from where we were the amount of damage that had been done, but there was just, you know, litter strewed all across the beach, broken Thai fishing boats, parts of the sailing boat, people's clothes. There were fishing boats that had gone all the way into the top of palm trees. That's how high they'd been carried. The hotel was destroyed. Everything was just littered across the beach. It was like a bomb, you know, like a war scene or something like that. And we walked across the beach, and at the far end of the beach, I found this child's doll just lying on the beach. And I just thought, oh my God, you know? And it sort of really brought it home. And I needed at that point to get out of there and to get up and find Jill. And so we hiked up to the top of this pass over to Tonsai, and people were screaming. There was someone shouting at us, you know, get down, get away from the ocean, get away from the ocean. It's coming again. There was a lot of conflicting information. No one knew what was happening. And I went down, and again, it was like another war scene in Tonsai. All the places that we'd wanted to stay in were absolutely just, they weren't there anymore. They were just destroyed. All the places we've been kind of hanging out were absolutely destroyed. All the boats were destroyed, and people were just wandering around like zombies. You know, people were just in shock. And I think I was in shock too. I still couldn't really accept that people might have been killed. Even at this stage, I just felt that it was something bad had happened, but everyone probably escaped. And, you know, as we were crossing over, we saw another sailboat that had been just broken in half on the rocks. And we came by really close to it on the path, and it was, you know, there's people's things inside, and but there was no one there, and I just didn't know what had happened. So we came over to the other side, and I kind of ran up this path to our little guest house, just really nervous now, really like wanting to see Jill there, wanting to find her. And when I got there, she wasn't there. And I really started to panic because she wasn't anywhere to be seen. And I was kind of just running around that area and shouting for her. And in my panic, I had missed this note that had been stuck to the door. And when I went back to the guest house, I saw it. And it was just three words: on the mountain. And so I started to make my way up to the top of the mountain. And Jill's story from this as well, it's worth hearing her perspective, because what happened to her is she came out, she heard people like screaming and running past her. And she came out and people were grabbing, you know, forcefully grabbing her and saying, "You have to run away. You have to run away. You have to go to higher ground." And she was distraught because she knew where I was and she knew that I would have been in a lot of danger. And it was her instinct to go looking for me. And she started to make her way down to the beach. And thank God she stopped and she said, this is stupid. I could get really hurt here and maybe he's safe, you know, what else can I do? So she started being one of the people to help round people up. And she was getting everyone together and saying, "We all have to go to the top of the mountain. There's no path anymore. Like, you get to the end of the path and then it's just thick jungle." But she and a bunch of other people were just kind of like fighting their way, bushwhacking through this jungle to get as high as they could. So meanwhile, I get back to her place. I see the note and I start doing the same. I start running through the jungle. And I see lots of people dotted around, and I'm sort of shouting her name, and you know, I keep walking. It feels like an eternity of just like going up and shouting her name, and it feels really hopeless. Like, what are my chances of finding someone amongst all these people in this crazy scenario in this huge, huge kind of jungle area? And someone hears me shouting, you know, "Jillian, Jill." And she comes past and she says, "Are you Aaron? Are you Aaron?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Jill's looking for you. She's about 100 feet up there." She points me in the right direction. And I ran up there and there was just a little clearing. And she was with about 40 or 50 other people. And I saw her and then she looked over and saw me and burst into tears and ran over to me, and we were just hugging each other. It felt so amazing to be reunited and know that she was safe.
I can imagine, man. It seems like sensory overload, because not just the devastation and death all around everyone, but the confusion about what actually happened, because you still didn't know.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest thing, you know, like in the movie of it, everyone knows instantly what's happened and is immediately on sort of panic mode and survival mode. But in reality, like you say, there was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of shock. There was a lot of denial of what was happening. There was a lot of people that were still just trying to go about their ordinary business, you know, like it was weird. It was really, really weird. And like I say, even with myself, I look back and I struggle to understand why I was in such denial about the severity of what had happened. But I think you're right. I think it was just a lack of knowledge at that point. But I got up there. This had been a few hours now after the wave had hit. And, you know, I said to all these people, we think it's safe now and we can come back down. And we did that. And even at this stage, I've got my phone and I phoned my mom, and it was probably about 4 a.m. or something UK time. And she answered, and I said, "Mom, something's happened. I don't know what's happened, but we're okay." And literally after that, the line went dead and we weren't able to do any communication for the next 10 days. And she always says, the fact that you got that call off, you know, she said, I wouldn't have been able to survive those 10 days not knowing what happened.
Yeah, because this was worldwide news, obviously.
I mean, yeah.
I was in the U.S. at the time, and we heard about it. That was the news of the day for several days.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, after that, she got out of bed and saw it and was just so thankful that I'd managed to get that message across, because I think that would have been just an unbearable, now that I'm a father, it would have been an unbearable weight knowing that your kid was there in danger.
Not knowing how your kids are doing for that period of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were stuck there.
Yeah. So after we kind of got ourselves together, we went down and everyone immediately started cleaning up. You know, I think by the next morning, pretty much everyone that was there was helping to move all this rubbish and timber and broken boats and trying to just clear up. And we were stuck there because the only way out of Tonsai and Rahlai is by boat, and there were no boats. They were all destroyed. And there was no food. Like I said, you know, there's no kind of natural food sources on the island there. And, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of food stored. And we couldn't eat the fish. And so, you know, very quickly there was a lack of food and they were airdropping rice. That's all they were, just rice, just packets of rice. And so for 10 days we ate rice, you know, we ate airdrop rice. I lost about 20 pounds, you know, and we helped people clean up. It was everyone kind of pitched in together and tried to sort of repair. More than anything, I suppose the people that were left, the Thai people that were left, helped them repair their lives a small bit, because, you know, they don't have any insurance for this. This is their livelihoods have been absolutely destroyed. And I guess we all just wanted to help in some way. And I felt very lucky because there were a lot of people around me that had been separated from family members, you know, like there was a guy I remember when we were helping to just carry stuff into this pile of rubbish. And he was talking about how his wife and kids had gone on ahead of him to Koh Phi Phi actually, and he couldn't get hold of them. And I can't imagine what he was going through, but he kind of wasn't letting it in. He was just working 12 hours a day to clear this thing and then sleeping, because how do you face something like that when you have no control over finding it? And so we felt very lucky that we had found ourselves and that we were both okay. That afternoon, there was a lot of people hurt. There was a lot of people that were being, you know, carried to kind of makeshift first aid centers, not even really medical centers, you know, but a lot of it was just swept away by the ocean. You know, it was one of the weird things was that it was a lot of it was just gone, you know, and it was very strange. So our guest house was still okay. So we slept there and, you know, other people bunked in. A lot of the places up in the mountain were okay. And some people left earlier, you know, like if you had, there were sort of priorities, and if you had family or kids elsewhere, or you had to, then people were allowed to ship off. But we stayed. It was such chaos everywhere. We just decided to stay and help, and we had no immediate urgency to get back like other people did. So we just decided to stay and help. And we had friends, you know, this guy, we and his wife, who ran the climbing kind of school and bar. We'd made friends with them and they really welcomed us in. And a couple of times they cooked for us. They caught a bunch of crickets and fried them up. They invited us round for some food. You know, we were hungry and they said, come around. We found some food. We're going to eat it. And we were really excited about it. It was a really nice thing for them to do. And we arrived and they'd fried up all these crickets. And, you know, Jill, she's Scottish, so she's a picky eater at the best of times. They really just do like meat and chips and that's about it up there. So, but we were hungry, man. And I was like, you know, I went full on into the crickets, and I think Jill had a couple and she just passed me the rest under the table.
So much for a vegetarian diet, right?
So much for vegetarianism. Yeah. I don't know how insects are included in that or not, but yeah, it was a real community spirit in some ways. It was very sad and quiet. You could feel something of the presence of what had just happened. And it was such a such an immediate change. But there was like, there was a couple of moments where it was nice. That was one. And there was another where we had somehow managed to track down. There was like a nice hotel on the other side of the island. You know, this was a nice hotel. This wasn't a backpacking area. So all the guests had been kind of immediately evacuated and the staff had gone. And we said, I think they've got some beer left there. You know, this is about 5 days in. And so we went over there and there was a couple of cases of beer and we sort of put them on our shoulders and walked back to the beach where everyone was working to clear up with this beer and just started handing it out to people. And it was just that moment of, I suppose, normality and being together and sort of saying a thank you. And, you know, everyone was so happy. And it is amazing how people come together in those environments. I think that the Thai people were really frightened. They were letting out fireworks, bangers every night and throwing them into the ocean to sort of ward off evil spirits. And they were really afraid. And we sort of all just, we all just came together, you know, and did our best to help in whatever way we could. And, you know, sadly, it wasn't a lot or enough, but we did what we could.
I can imagine for people like that, that don't know what happened and they'd never seen it happen before. Obviously, logic tells you it might happen again.
Yeah.
It's got to be frightening.
Yeah. And because there was no, we had no communication really. A lot of, you know, some people, we, by that point, you know, some people had got the information that it was an earthquake and there was a tsunami, but we had no real access to information other than sort of hearsay and what people were saying. So you didn't know what was happening. And we were anxious to contact people at home again and let them know how things were. So it was a stressful time. But I think it was a long time before I really processed how lucky we were. You know, I think in the moment, you're just dealing with, as you call it, this sensory overload and this incredibly shocking situation, which has suddenly happened out of the blue. You know, it was a beautiful blue sky day, perfect day, everyone's smiling, happy. And then all of a sudden, it just without any warning whatsoever, it changed. And I think the suddenness of that was just incredibly shocking. And it took us both a long time to process and really appreciate how lucky we were.
The conversations you and Jillian must have had in thinking back, like, I mean, now you're telling the story, but thinking back, wow, what if we had not made that decision and another decision, and then you ate the meat, and it's just like a chain reaction of things.
Yeah, I think I gave up like 8 of my 9 lives on that day, because it was so many to look back and see those 5 or 6 decisions, which at the time were tiny decisions, inconsequential decisions, and yet later on they would be life or death decisions. And it made me think, really, you don't know those moments when they're happening. You know them in retrospect, but you don't know them when they're happening. And it's kind of a hard thing to realize in a way. It's a hard, because there's a lack of control to that, right? You can't prepare for that. So I think all you can do in a way is just be really grateful. And I think that one of the lessons afterwards, I became really kind of obsessed with death and the nature of it. And I'm kind of a philosophical guy, I guess. And I read a lot about it. I was trying to understand what happened and what it meant that we had survived and so many people didn't, and what it meant, these chance situations. And I don't know if you can face, I think in some ways it's really to have a moment like that, to have a sort of near death experience like that is, you know, makes you really look at yourself and how you're living your life in a different way. If there's a positive to bring from it, I guess that's the positive, to realize that the day that you'll die will be today. It's not going to be someday in the future. The day that it happens will be today. And that moment can happen at any time. And we can't face it head on. I try to understand, like, if I could accept, I somehow felt if I could fully accept the reality of it and face it head on, then I would somehow kind of overcome this fear of death. But I don't know if we're, you know, I don't know if human beings have evolved to be able to do that. I don't think you can face the reality of it. We sort of picture it as some distant thing in the future and put it out of our minds. And I think when you're confronted with it and you realize that the day it will happen will be now, it changes your understanding of that in quite a fundamental way. And, you know, when I got back, I made a lot of changes to my life. It didn't happen instantly, but I started to really think about what I really wanted to do, you know, what was really important to me, and to try and stop living my life for other people, in the sense that so much of what we do to try and, for our ego, to be successful or to appear successful or cool or all the rest of the things that we want other people to see us as. And a lot of the times those things we aren't for ourselves, right? If we were to take all of that out, what would be the decisions that you would make? And I think if you realize your own mortality, if you realize the impermanence of life and the fragility of life, then in some ways that frees you up to make those big decisions for yourself, to live the life that you really want to live. And, you know, soon after that, I quit my job in the music industry. It was a great job, but, you know, I always wanted to be on the other side of it. I always wanted to be making the music, not doing the business of the music, but I probably wasn't good enough. And so I ended up becoming a writer, which was kind of my lifelong dream, and trying to make that work. And I don't know if I would have had the courage to pursue that without that event kind of shaking things up for me.
Isn't it interesting that it takes something like that for us to realize, to kind of step back and look at, wow, what am I really doing with my life?
Yeah, absolutely. We're on autopilot so much, you know. In modern life, particularly, we have such a busy life, and it's so even more so now. It's so filled with information. It's so filled with busyness. We kind of hold up that mantle of being busy and as a kind of emblem of pride, right? And so we don't have enough space to really consider some of those big questions. And I think a big event like that just knocks a bunch of that rubbish out of your head and gives you, for a while at least, the space to see how life is, how life truly is, how lucky we are to be alive. And I think that one of the big things I've taken from it is gratitude. I think gratitude is really, really important. And it's easy to go through life without thinking about that, because we're always striving for the next thing. We live in a really ambitious culture. We're always striving for the next thing and trying to achieve the next thing, and often at the expense of being grateful for where we already are and present and appreciative of that. And we have a little Thai mask that we bought in Phuket, and we've got it hanging on our dining room table because I want to sit around that table with my family and just remember, just be grateful and remember that I came very close to not having that. You know, I came very close to the last, you know, 18 years or so, not being there for it, and not having my children, and not becoming a writer, and not having all those thousands of experiences that have filled me with so much joy and all the rest. And I came very close to not having that. I came five decisions away from not having that. And then that's made me incredibly grateful for every day and incredibly determined to kind of keep that attitude of just thanks for being alive and understanding that it can be taken from you every minute. It doesn't mean you have to be fearful of that, because that's inevitable. But what it does mean is that you can't waste the time you have.
This happened in 2004. Have you been back there since then?
Yeah, I don't know why I did it. About 4 or 5 years later, I went back with a friend of mine. It was actually a huge mistake, but it's this famous place for rock climbing, and he really wanted to go. And I was just about to get married to Jill, actually. So, you know, as a kind of, before we did that, we wanted to go back there on a climbing trip, and immediately, we weren't supposed to stay there for very long, but immediately when I got there, I knew it was a mistake, because I just felt so much the kind of ghosts of what had happened, and no one else did. You know, it was like life had returned to normal, and people were sitting on the beach as they were before it happened, and everything had been rebuilt, and There were tourists there and people were all smiling and laughs, and it was kind of shocking how it can return to normal. And it was kind of shocking that so much devastation occurred in this place, and yet here I am just standing here again. And I don't know why I went back. To this day, I really don't know why I went back. I guess I felt I had to, but I found it really hard. And I actually ended up leaving pretty quickly after that.
I tend to think of like someone that's in the military and goes travels to another country during war and all the horror of that, but then going back after the war to the same place, it's probably a similar experience.
Yeah, it is. And I guess there is a positive to that, which is, you know, these people had rebuilt their lives. Life goes on, and that's a good thing. We can't stay kind of mired in that tragedy forever. You know, life is for living, and I'm a firm believer of that. So I think it is, of course, it's a positive thing. I just, for me personally, it felt very strange. I really felt the presence of what had happened there. I couldn't stop looking around and thinking, right, where people stood right here, this happened, and now it's disappeared and gone. And that felt strange. Yeah.
Life is very different for you now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm enjoying life now. Like I said, that life is for the living, so you gotta enjoy it and be happy and grateful for it, for sure.
You and Jillian got married. You got a family. You've got kids, right?
Yeah, we got married. Got married up in Scotland. I even had the kilt on for that. And about 7 years ago now, we actually moved to the States originally. For a short-term job, but we got stuck here. I live out in Colorado, which famously gets 300 days sunshine a year, and I think the UK gets the other 65, so I feel like it's a pretty good trade.
If anyone's wondering why you have such high-quality audio, you are a podcaster, and your podcast, I know my listeners are going to love your podcast, because it's called Armchair Explorer. World's greatest adventurers tell their best story from the road. That sounds, and I've listened to some of the episodes. Tell us about this show.
Yeah, thank you. One of the reasons I'm really honored to be on is because I think there's some synergy between our shows in the sense that they're both about stories, and they're both about kind of incredible stories that you may not get a chance to experience yourself. And I absolutely love the concept of your show and how you do it. And my show's, you know, it's about adventure. It's about travel. I've been lucky to have a bunch of pretty amazing guests telling their stories, from, you know, the explorer Ed Stafford talking about his 2.5 year trek along the Amazon River. He's the first person to walk the length of the Amazon. I've got an episode coming out with a woman who rode 2,000 miles down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kind of raise awareness about all that's happening kind of post-Vietnam War there, in terms of some of the devastation that still exists, but also so much of the beauty of stories about, you know, astronauts doing their first spacewalk, Olympic athletes, backcountry skiing in Alaska. So I try, like you a little bit, I guess I try and tell incredible stories that inspire people, that take people out of their ordinary lives for a short period of time and celebrate really the beauty and wonder of the outdoors and the pure joy of just exploring this amazing planet. So I was struck by this disaster, but it didn't knock out the love of traveling for me. And I subsequently became a travel writer, actually. And yeah, it's a wonderful way to tell stories. But my dirty secret about this, this good sound is I'm actually currently in my walk-in wardrobe, surrounded by like these big blankets that I've put up against all the walls. So, you know, it's not quite a high-tech studio. The only problem is Jill's getting pretty annoyed with me. She's like, come on, you know, every week you just have to take everything out and do this. But yeah, so maybe I'll have to move one of these days.
So your podcast can be found on probably just about any podcast app, and the website is armchair-explorer.com.
That's right. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate it.
I'll have links. You're on all the socials as Armchair Explorer Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And we'll have links to all that in the show notes for this episode. Aaron, thanks for coming on, telling your story.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. It's like I said, it's been an absolute honor, Scott. I appreciate it.
I have a bunch of things I need to tell you about. During our conversation, Aaron mentioned a movie It's called The Impossible. And right at this moment, it's available on Netflix. So if you want to get a sense of what happened in Thailand that day, I recommend you watch it. And in the near future, I'm going to be doing a special Q&A episode. Some listeners in the Facebook group suggested this, and it's actually something I was thinking about doing anyway. It wouldn't replace one of the regular episodes. This would be on a Friday in between episodes. So think about what you'd like to ask me. It can be about the podcast or anything else. Well, almost anything else, I guess. Now, keep in mind, some of the people in the Facebook group have already sent in questions such as, how do you find your guests and what's your favorite episode? So don't ask those things. And when you have your question, you can call into the podcast voicemail line, 727-386-9468, and leave your question in a voicemail. If you can't do that, you can send me an audio file by email to scott@whatwasthatlike.com. I'm going to collect all the questions and answer all of them in a special episode coming up in the near future. It's going to be pretty fun. And if you enjoy hearing actual 911 calls and the backstory that goes with them, I recommend you sign up as a patron and support the show. For $5 a month, you get access to all of my exclusive bonus content called Raw Audio. And Raw Audio Episode 10 just went live. In this episode, a Boy Scout leader is taking some boys on a hike and they encounter a bear.
How bad are you injured?
Pretty bad.
Okay, you're bleeding?
A little girl calls 911 in the middle of the night.
Then what made you wake up tonight?
I heard a gunshot.
You heard a gun?
Yes, and I see a bullet laying on the floor. I think it's a bullet.
And a car crashes into a grocery store, and then things get worse.
Oh my God.
What's going on?
Oh my God.
What's going on?
He's trying to kill himself.
So don't miss out on this stuff. You can get access to all of the Raw Audio episodes, past and future, by becoming a patron at whatwasthatlike.com/support. And now, a question. Are you into plants? Do you wish you had a green thumb? Well, you might like this podcast. The host is Maria, and she is the plant lady at Bloom and Grow Radio. Check this out.
Have you ever killed a houseplant before? I know I have. In fact, I've killed so many houseplants that I actually created a podcast all about plant care, Bloom and Grow Radio, the podcast for plant people where we learn how to not only stop killing our houseplants, but learn how to help them thrive, grow our indoor jungles, and cultivate more joy in our lives. On Bloom and Grow Radio, I interview planty experts to get answers to the plant care questions we all have, but might be a little nervous to ask, like, what the heck is bright indirect light? What is soil and potting mix actually made up of? Or what is the best way to water my plants? For me, the mind-blowing thing about plant care is that it is so much more than just making our homes look Instagrammable. Plants are amazing tools for self-care. They help us disconnect from screens, reconnect with nature and ourselves, and they remind us things like growth is always happening and around us, dormancy is sometimes necessary, and something as simple as it's important to water yourself. If you want to grow, we've got an episode for you. So what are you waiting for? Join our community of plant friends and subscribe to the Bloom and Grow radio podcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast player, or listen on our website at bloomandgrowradio.com/podcast so we can all keep blooming and keep growing.
And finally, we have a voicemail from Karen, and she listens to the podcast in Scotland.
Hi, Scott. I thought I'd drop you a quick line to say how much I'm enjoying the What Was That Like podcast. I live on an island in the Outer Hebrides off the northwest coast of Scotland and work from home, so listen to loads of podcasts all day, every day. After finding What Was That Like, I am binge listening to every episode. I just love it. You have a great voice. I find it strangely comforting. Keep up the great work, and I hope you know it's appreciated and keeping me going through a dark and dismal winter in Scotland.
Thanks for that message, Karen. And of course, I would love to hear from you. Yeah, that's right. I'm talking to you. I mean, we're almost to the end of this episode, and it's just you and me here, right? I would like for you to call in and leave a voicemail. It can be a comment, a question, a suggestion, whatever. Just call 727-386-9468 and leave it there. Or you can email me your audio at scott@whatwasthatlike.com. It would make me really happy to hear from you. So that's it for this time. I hope you're doing well and staying safe. I'll see you in 2 weeks.